Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and my guest today is Jason Breifel. He's the interim president of the Senior Executives Association, succeeding Carol Bonacero, who recently retired. First, congratulations. Second, condolences. So, tough job, and you stepped right into it. You had been handling a lot of legislative stuff for the SEA, though, correct?
That's correct, Mike. I've been working with SEA for about 3.5 years now, the past year of which as the legislative director, and I've stepped into the interim president role here while we continue and move our search process for a full-time president towards its conclusion. And it certainly is an interesting time to be in this role.
Well, absolutely. Now, you were talking about the executive order. What does that do?
Sure. So this December, President Obama issued an executive order intended to strengthen the SES. This followed on the meeting that the president had the preceding winter with the executive corps. And the SES order has several elements, some for immediate application and others for long-term application that are designed to improve the management of the corps, the selection of the corps, as well as addressing some of the compensation and other elements related to issues that SEA and other groups have been raising for some time related to figuring out ways to strengthen the SES, letting folks have the opportunity to more easily apply or doing so in a less burdensome way, and figuring out ways to make these positions and the risk-reward imbalance that exists with entering the SES, trying to tackle some of those areas that we've seen for some years at SEA's perspective that might be causing some of the best and brightest, the most talented GS-14s and 15s, or those from the private sector to opt to not enter the SES in government. And we're concerned, and I think the president is concerned, about some of those factors and how it affects the government's long-term capability to manage itself, manage its operations, and ultimately deliver for the American people.
Well, the fact this is so late in the Obama administration, is that a factor?
It is a bit of a concern or a challenge, I think, to put a program like this in place to implement all of these changes and initiatives at a time when the administration is winding down. And some of the political appointees who are responsible for some of these initiatives, both at the government-wide level as well as at the agency level, might not be here at the end of the administration. So for us, I think SEA absolutely wishes that the president's engagement with the executive corps, with his executive corps, and these initiatives had come sooner. But nonetheless, we're working as closely as we can with the administration and with other stakeholders to try to make the efforts of the executive order as successful as possible.
Well, I know your predecessor, Carol Bonacero, who'd been president for a long, long time, had some major issues with this administration, particularly in the last couple of years, things about awards for senior executives and sort of doing some things kind of in the dark so that while they got done, the people, the American public didn't see it being done, you know, the image of giving top bureaucrats big awards.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Mike. I think that was a fallout that continued starting with the Great Recession and the animus in the public towards private sector executives who were still getting these golden parachutes and these big bonus packages, even though they almost brought our economy down. That animus towards executives in general stuck on the federal executive corps and only grew after 2010 with the Tea Party takeover of the House of Representatives. But you are right that in that environment, the president was incredibly hesitant, and this administration was incredibly hesitant to talk about the significant accomplishments that career executives were leading in their agencies. And in fact, for the first 6 years of the administration, there was a gag order on agencies being allowed to talk about their presidential distinguished and meritorious rank award winners, which to SEA was an absolutely incredible decision from an administration because it was taking away that opportunity to talk about the amazing work that federal executives, federal employees, and federal agencies are performing every day.
You know, you can understand, though, from a political point of view and maybe calming the waters a little bit too. That was a scary time, the Great Recession, and for the government to not only appear, it was doing it, but for the government to openly say it was giving awards to top executives, even though those awards were $10,000 or $20,000, a lot of people thought they were $20 million parachutes like on Wall Street.
You're right. And you know, I think we absolutely understand the political environment. However, from SEA's perspective, it was an opportunity for a teachable moment to explain the significant return on investment for perhaps rewarding someone with the president's highest honor for efforts that saved the government millions or billions of dollars. The last year's slate of rank award winners, if I recall correctly, there was about 25 or so distinguished rank award winners. They helped save the government $94 billion. I would think that a bonus from the president in exchange for that level of accomplishment and savings would be appreciated by the public who often only hears the negative stories about government. And I think for us, that's a significantly lost opportunity. And we're lost opportunities over a course of many years.
Well, I've often thought and said that if somebody could make a good documentary, no hype either way, no politics, just a documentary of your senior executive banquet that frequently held at the State Department. I've been to a number of them. There's several hundred award winners there. And whatever table you're at and you start talking to these people, you're in absolute awe of what they did, what they accomplished. And then when you read the details about what they saved, and this is not paper money to coin a race. This is very serious programs and life-saving sorts of things. I think if you could get that and get it on prime time, people would have a very different thought about what government workers do.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mike. And it's not only individual accomplishments; it's the accomplishments that these executives led their teams and their organizations to accomplish. So, although a particular executive might win that presidential rank award, it really isn't just about that person and their leadership capability. These rewards are based on a sustained demonstration of the highest caliber of leadership, and that's something that should be rewarded and talked about. And again, to your point, I think it could go towards reversing some of those trend lines that we see when the public is losing its trust and confidence in the government across the board. And it's oftentimes because they're only hearing those negative stories and not those great stories.
Yeah. Well, there's a movie about several movies, but one particular about the hunt for bin Laden, Hollywood production, very good. But there's another one that only interviews the people that were involved in it. And a goodly number of the team, more than half, were women. And it shows it from their perspective and how they put this together. And you think there is some very bright, dedicated people at the Central Intelligence Agency.
Absolutely. And don't you hope that we do have that caliber of people? Our world is getting more and more complex. And the government is not staffed by a bunch of clerks and so-called bureaucrats, as perhaps was the case 40 or 50 or 70 years ago. We really are a high-knowledge, high-skill government. And I don't think that the public fully appreciates that fact. And again, that's another area that needs to be talked about more. We have serious professionals working for the federal government tackling some of the biggest and thorniest challenges our country's facing.
You know, it's interesting you'd say that. It triggered a memory I had about people's perception of the government. You know, that everybody in Washington, it's an army of clerks in green eyeshades with sleeves rolled up, and they all work in one building. And I remember talking to a political appointee, very high at level, who was from the Pittsburgh area, and we were having lunch, and he said when he came to D.C., he had no knowledge of how the government worked or anything. He was an expert in his field, but he didn't know how the federal government worked. And he said he literally thought that he would be in a building with other top agency heads and executives, and that they would all have lunch every day. And he thought it was kind of like a club. So totally a bad picture of what the government is.
Yeah, and that I think fuel some of this these attacks and the negative perception there. And again, I think that's the challenge for not only organizations like SEA, but for all federal employee organizations and for the government itself, whether that be the president or individual agencies. The president has said on many occasions, I think I read an article perhaps on Federal News Radio that talked about the president being at South by Southwest and saying the government needs to talk about its accomplishments more. And there will be an opportunity to do so in about 2 months here with Public Service Recognition Week. And it's unfortunate that every week isn't Public Service Recognition Week because those dedicated employees are showing up every day of the week and every day of the year, not just during that 1 week when we honor them.
We'll take a short break now. We're talking with Jason Breifel, interim president of the Senior Executive Association, on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn with Mike Causey. We're talking with Jason Breifel. He's interim president of the Senior Executives Association. Talk about the VA situation. You know, I think most people are aware of the, quote, scandal involving at least two VA hospitals, facilities cooking the books, people call for heads to roll. Some heads did roll, and now they seem to have rolled back. What's going on over there?
Sure. So it's a very dynamic situation at the VA, both between proposals coming out of the agency and proposals coming from Capitol Hill, and SEA is certainly in the thick of it here. And part of our approach to this situation and to the broader conversation around the VA is ensuring at the end of the day any policy decisions that are made are ultimately going to be in the best interest of the veterans who are served at the agency. And for us, some of these proposals, for example, making all senior executives at will, which is coming from some folks in the majority on Capitol Hill, or the Secretary's proposal to pull the entire executive corps into Title 38 and out of Title 5 because he was disappointed that the agency lost three cases in a row at the Merit Systems Protection Board. Those are proposals that have very dangerous implications, not only for the VA, but for the federal government writ large.
Well, I mean, that at-will thing, that could lead very quickly to a return to the spoil systems starting at the very top, huh?
Absolutely, Mike. And I think that's what SEA, as well as senior executives at the agency, are most concerned about. SEA performed a survey of senior executives, both our members as well as non-member executives at the agency, to ask them about their perspective on the Secretary's proposal, whether they thought it would help the agency in terms of filling these leadership roles that oftentimes have had long periods of vacancy, addressing some of the compensation imbalance issues relative to private sector healthcare providers, addressing the accountability issues. And one of the major themes that emerged from that survey, which we're hoping to have out the door today or tomorrow, is that concern about the politicization of not only the executive corps, but the agency writ large. And the broader concern there is that if senior executives, career leaders, or career employees in general don't have the ability to stand up to political leaders, to politically driven policies and say, you know, boss, that's not going to work out. That's not going to be in the best interest of our agency, the mission, or the veterans. If folks don't have that ability, that backstop to stand up and say, no, we're very concerned, and executives at the VA are very concerned what the negative implications will be for the veterans that they care, and everyone in this country, frankly, cares so much about doing the right thing for.
Yeah, let me jump over to the Defense Department now. You know, whenever major changes for the civil service are brought into play. They often start at the Defense Department. Buyouts is a good example of that. It started at Army, Navy, and Air Force and spread to other agencies. And I guess part of it is because defense is so big, it's nearly half the government. And also, it seems to be easier to get things rolling there. Maybe it's the military concept of, you know, salute and carry on. Nine, 10 years ago, during the Bush administration, defense set up something called the National Security Personnel System, and it was supposed to, it was pay banding, eliminated grades, it was going to, you know, reform the civil service. Reform is a word often used in Washington. The federal unions objected to it, to a man. They objected to it at Department of Homeland Security. They fought it for several years to the point where Homeland Security didn't do it, and defense limited it only to people who were in non-bargaining units, meaning people who weren't under the jurisdiction of federal unions. Well, almost the day that President Obama was elected and the Democrats took over Congress, they repealed this, said it was a terrible idea, and the system had to be put back together. People who weren't in grades had to be put in grades and pay adjusted and that sort of thing. Now, they're talking about doing it again in the Defense Department, but this time the unions are beating on the doors to get into it. What's changed, do you think?
So there is a long history to this issue, and a history that I was not fully involved with, but I do understand that post-NSPS, the New Beginnings program was put in place, and that was the program that the labor organizations affected at the agency have been engaging with the agency for some time to bring to fruition. My understanding of part of the challenge behind the NSPS was linking up that organizational and individual performance appraisals, and then fairly doling out bonuses and performance incentives as appropriate. Unfortunately, my understanding is some of the good elements of NSPS were also thrown out with those other elements that did cause, I think, legitimate concern for some employees. And one of those areas being successfully linking individual and organizational performance, and bringing us back to where things are now. New Beginnings, I think, is ready to take off, but somewhat in parallel for the past year or two, at the direction of the Secretary of Defense, the agency has pulled together a Force of the Future proposal, which contains elements that relate both to the military services as well as the civilian and contractor workforces. And part of that proposal, as I understand it, for the civilian side of DOD, would be pulling most of the non-bargaining unit employees out of Title V and into Title X of the code, which would provide the agency with more flexibility in terms of compensation, but also employment protections, ability to collectively bargain, and other areas like that. And I do know that proposal has raised similar concerns as NSPS did in the past, although some of them are a bit different.
Would it make it easier to fire people?
As I understand it, that would be one of the enhancements. I believe under Title X, it is easier. There's less process involved with holding employees accountable under Title X as compared to Title V.
Well, you know, as it is with the administration's SES proposal for change, this one seems to be coming awfully late in the administration in the eighth year, and there's, given the hostility in Congress between Republicans and Democrats, I would think it's very likely that if this thing were passed into law and put into place, if they had even had time for it, that it might very well be repealed by the next Congress, by the next president, just as the NSPS was.
I think you're right, Mike, and I think that's part of the challenge with some of the things that the administration appears to be pursuing at the moment. Some of these ideas at their surface level, these proposals, might sound good in a room at the executive office or in OMB, but not all of the details in terms of how this will affect employees, how this will affect agencies, what the long-term implications will be. I don't necessarily get the sense that all of those factors have been thought through. And my sense and some of the conversations that I've had with career leaders is that there are many wheels being spun, but not for much tangible benefit. And I don't know if that is necessarily the best way to be spending a last year of a presidency that appears to be trying to cement some legacy issues, but perhaps hasn't fully thought through some of those proposals.
That's very interesting you say that. I used to have a boss, and we'd have a weekly or biweekly meeting, and he would, the ground rules were, I'm going to address certain issues and make certain statements for the record, but if I, while I'm talking, I raise my left hand, that means don't pay any attention, it's not going to happen. Listen, Jason, thank you so much for being with us again. Congratulations, Mr. Interim President, and we'll talk to you later.
My pleasure, Mike. Look forward to talking to you soon.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from Katie Maddox, the Deputy Director of Government Affairs for the Federal Managers Association, on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Is Katie Maddox, and she is Katie, what is your title?
Director of Government Affairs.
Director of Government Affairs for the Federal Managers Association. And FMA, I think you're smack dab in the midst of your national convention, correct?
Correct. Today is actually our last day, and we're doing our collective lobbying on the Hill today. You know, I gave everyone the news last night of what's going on in the Metro, but, you know, I said, you can't keep FMA down just because metros aren't running. We're still going to go meet with our representatives and senators and let them know what's going on back in our local chapters across the country.
Well, you know, what a time for people to arrive from all over the country. And, I mean, it was a surprise to us, and mm-hmm. we live here. So this is amazing. And, of course, I think some people are uneasy because they wonder if there is maybe a hidden reason that Metro is closed today. But we shall see.
We will see.
Yeah. Katie, lots of things to talk about here. One of them is the proposed federal employee pay raise for January 2017. Mm-hmm. Now, the administration has proposed one amount. What is that again? Is that?
So in the president's budget proposal, he called for a 1.6% raise,
okay,
which is better than what we've seen in the past. The last couple, last 3 years, I believe, we've seen anywhere from a 1% to a 1.3%. So, you know, we're getting very, very tiny bump from President Obama for next year. But Representative Connolly has introduced the FAIR Act, which would provide a 5.3% raise to federal workers. And that includes, you know, a general 3.9% raise and then an additional 1.4% for locality pay. And this has always been on the mind of FMA. I believe our members are talking about this today to their members of Congress. But federal pay is not as competitive as the private sector. And by offering, you know, this 5.3%, we are offering a competitive workforce. We're going to be attracting and retaining, you know, incredible people, you know, to federal agencies and departments, and we're going to be getting a lot of work done. So really, this pay is just going to improve the federal workforce.
I went to a cyber worker conference earlier this week, and very impressive people there. Really mm-hmm. good speakers and interesting conversation. And you know, this is cyber thing. Everybody, I think, now understands how important that is.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, the OPM was breached, the Thrift Savings Plan was breached. And as I was telling somebody, I said somewhere probably in the People's Republic of China, in a building, somebody has your mother's maiden name. They have your social security number. They know all of these things about you because of the various breaches at federal agencies. And yet, I believe the COO of the Health and Human Services, one of the major departments, said that 40% of their cyber jobs, their high-tech jobs, were vacant.
Mm-hmm.
And that people wanted to come to work for government. You know, they felt the call. They wanted to be part of it. And yet they can't recruit people because of this, in part because of the salaries.
Right. And I know, I believe it was in January, FMA was at a meeting for the National Council of Federal Labor Management Relations. And Acting Director Beth Cobert is our moderator. She's our chairperson.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just commenting on how we need to get the best and brightest in on cybersecurity. They need, you know, we need to offer a competitive salary to bring people in, you know, go over our systems, make sure that this cyber breach does not never happens again. And we really need to, you know, offer a competitive salary, competitive benefits, it just to bring people in.
Yeah, yeah, they were talking about the workforce changes that need to be made with, you know, dealing with millennials and even the things like dress codes. But
mm-hmm.
but again, money is a critical thing. On this pay raise, I know you can't say it and shouldn't say it because you're working for it, but I would think 5.3% raise, given the current political climate, maybe isn't in the wind. But if it were to pass, this is an election year, anything can happen. If it were to pass Congress and if the president signed it, you're talking about 3.9% across the board, I believe you said,
mm-hmm.
and 1.4% for locality pay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, would you kind of run down for people who are not familiar with this how the locality pay system works?
Locality pay system, there are areas throughout the country that pay is calculated a little bit differently in order to better accommodate, you know, that local market. So someone who is working in San Francisco, say in cybersecurity, where that is a big, very big area, cybersecurity is.
Right,
and
Silicon Valley.
So they're trying to make sure that federal pay remains at a competitive level and we can still attract people. I know during our national convention, Representative Stephen Lynch from Massachusetts gave our keynote address, and he commented on how in the past 6 years, when federal pay was, you know, either frozen or got, you know, minor increases, private sector pay, that increased over those 6 years by about 10%. So still, the federal government needs to catch up with the rest of the country.
Right. And when you have these locality pay areas, because Washington, Baltimore is a huge locality pay area, New York City, and you have places like Houston, and I think this always surprises people, federal salaries in Houston are higher than they are in Washington, D.C., and the Baltimore area, all things being equal, thanks to locality pay.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, when they look at try to compare private sector wages with salaries that are paid in the government for the same or similar jobs. And in Houston, before the oil glut, at least anyhow, you had a large number of petroleum engineers,
mm-hmm.
and they get into that mix, so that brings the level up. But a number of places have been added to the locality pay area over the past couple of years, haven't they?
They have. And again, that goes back to how the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates that, how they're looking at, you know, cost of living in areas, like you said, with Houston, like how that market looks, and they do comparisons with others as well. So, you know, kudos to BLS for figuring out how much to pay people. You know, they're doing a great job over
there. Yeah, and I guess the other thing, too, and in fact, the subject of today's federal report, my column, is it's something like, if you want more money, go west, young man,
mm-hmm.
because San Francisco and L.A. and places like that pay better than they do in Washington.
It's a booming area.
Yeah. I guess one of the sad things that most people, if they ever knew, have probably forgotten, is that the 1990 Federal Pay Act, FEPCA, it came to being in the under the administration of George H.W. Bush, Bush the first, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a Republican president, a Democratic Congress. They all agreed that this is the way to go. And the plan was, I believe, with a series of catch-up pay raises over a 13-year period, they would bring federal workers close to so-called comparability with the private sector. And when President Clinton was elected, he was the first president to actually deal with this. Came to town, looked at Washington salaries compared to Arkansas now that we were doing this, and recommended a zero pay raise. Mm-hmm. And then Congress overrode him, thanks to Steny Hoyer in the House and Frank Wolf in the Senate and others. But that pattern continued for all of his 7 years in office. It continued for a George W. Bush, and it's pretty much continued with President Obama. So federal workers, I don't believe, have ever had the pay raise in any year that was envisioned for them by FEPCA, this Federal Pay Act. Is that correct?
You know, I'd have to go double-check that, but that sounds about right. And, you know, going back to what you were saying about comparing, you know, Washington, D.C. salaries to Arkansas salaries, I mean, that's comparing apples and
exactly.
oranges.
Exactly,
And that you know, just doing a blind comparison like that, you're not taking into account cost of living, how much real estate is, you know, what the going salary is, what is demanded of workers. And so you can't just do a blind comparison like that. You really need to look at the nuances of what is being done, what your community is like. You really need to sit down and study that thoroughly.
Yeah, and it's a complicated thing. And, of course, the Carter administration wanted to go total compensation. That is, look at the value of perks and benefits and mm-hmm. compare them. So the bottom line is FEPCA has never, I don't believe, it's worked a single year the way it was intended.
Okay.
Talk about you said you wanted to talk about the Defense Workforce Flexibility Act. What's that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's from Mark Wayne Mullen in Oklahoma's 2nd District and Steve Russell from Oklahoma's 5th District. And, you know, I got to say, FMA members, they really know how to get stuff done. And our chapter out there in Mr. Mullen's district worked with him. And basically what it does is allows temporary workers in the Department of Defense to apply for vacant permanent positions under the same procedure that permanent workers use for internal merit-based promotions, which is a great idea, and it's such common sense. You know, so you have a temporary worker who's been at, you know, Tinker Air Force Base or something like that, and, you know, they've been doing the job on a temporary for a temporary time, a permanent position opens up and they can go apply for it as if they were permanent. You know, they've been doing the work. They know the ins and outs of the duties and what needs to be done. And they should be considered, you know, at the same level as a permanent employee. So, you know, Mr. Mullen and Mr. Russell, they're just trying to make the federal workforce more efficient in DOD. And, you know, thank you to them. It's a great idea. And thank you to our FMA chapter who worked really hard with them.
Well, they've obviously figured out to what a lot of politicians don't know, and that is that the federal workforce, the federal employee vote, if there is such a thing, is very important in places like Oklahoma. It's not a heavily populated state, mm-hmm. and yet, as you pointed out, you have Tinker Air Force Base there. The Postal Service has a major facility, training facility, I think in Norman. FAA has its air traffic control school out there, and there are a huge number of federal workers in the state of Oklahoma.
Oh, indeed.
As there are, you know, places like Utah that we don't think of offhand. As a lobbyist, how hard is it to convince members of Congress that there are lots of federal workers in their district and they should, you know, take a look at their plight?
You know, when I started working at FMA, I remember my former supervisor, you know, she would have a hard time every once in a while. She'd go into a district, you know, a congressman's office, and, you know, they'd say, I don't have any federal workers mm-hmm. in my district. And she'd just be like, no, that's not true. Every district has one Social Security office. You have a post office. There are federal workers right there.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, it's become just kind of this misconception that, you know, federal workers just are in, you know, the D.C. Beltway, and that's not true. The majority of federal workers are actually in California and Texas and New York, I believe.
Yeah, Florida's huge numbers, too, yeah.
Yeah, so we're across the country, and as I mentioned earlier today, FMA is doing our day on the Hill today. All of our folks are out there, and they're meeting with, you know, their representatives, their senators, and reminding them what they do, you know, what they do at the Marine Corps Air Station in Cherry Point, what they do at the Army Depot in Corpus Christi, what they do at Beale Air Force Base, what they do at Travis Air Force Base, and just giving them a rundown of, you know, what issues they're seeing in the field and what Congress can do to help them out.
Katie, we need to take a short break here. We'll be right back talking with Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Katie Maddox from the Federal Managers Association. FMA is winding up its national convention today, and of all times for Metro to be shut down. So your members are getting to Capitol Hill the best way they can, huh?
They can, and you know what? I actually just got a text message from our new Region 1 director, and he's already on the Hill, and he's dropping off information. He's talking to folks, so we're up there. We're walking around. It's great.
By hook or by crook, they'll get there.
Yeah.
Hey, Katie, you know, this time last year we were talking about, and it turned out it wasn't hype, talking about the possibility of furloughs, which happened, and then later on down the road, shutdowns and that sort of thing. Nothing like that this year. What's happened?
You know, a couple things have happened. You know, after the 2013 shutdown, I think America and our elected officials were really reminded and, you know, got a rude awakening of, you know, that you cannot take the federal government for granted. And, you know, federal workers provide a lot of resources that are in high demand. You know, we make sure our interstates are, you know, paved and working, you know, protecting food, making sure flights get out safe, protecting our borders. And, you know, I think, you know, unfortunately it came to the fact that we got a shutdown in order to remind people of how important it was. And I think that kind of kicked everyone in gear to make sure, you know, to really try. And, you know, unfortunately, we are running on continuing resolutions. We aren't going through the appropriations process. But, you know, we haven't had a shutdown since. We've had a couple threats, but luckily nothing has come to fruition because I think everyone remembered what happened. And also, I think, you know, we are in the midst of the election season.
Yeah.
And I think it's really hard to go back to their districts and say, you know, I couldn't prevent another shutdown. So I think that really helps as well.
Well, it seems that, and it almost has to happen every 5 or 10 years, but you'll have a shutdown for whatever reason. And right or wrong, the Republicans usually take the hit on that, even though in this last time around, the administration, the White House, thought up the idea of sequestration, kind of a poison pill, and dropped it on the Congress. But nevertheless, the Republicans took the hit. And a lot of people, I guess most people, don't realize what federal workers do, what the government does. We take it for granted. We assume one of my colleagues has an app on his cell phone, and he showed me yesterday in real time all the air traffic in the United States. And it's absolutely,
it's impressive.
It's fascinating and frightening at the same time. But these air traffic controllers need to be, you know, up to speed at all times.
Yeah.
And when you have a national park shut down, when you have tourist attractions here in Washington shut down, just as the tourists, particularly these high school groups, are coming in, that is bad publicity for whoever happens to be their member of Congress.
And I know, I feel kind of like the general idea from, you know, your average Joe American is, you know, a federal worker is someone who sits, you know, in the middle of a big, huge, nondescript building who does data collection or, you know, some other bureaucratic process, and that's not the case at all. We have social workers, you know, in Social Security, you know, going out, making sure people are, you know, getting the benefits that they need. We have medical providers in the VA and DOD making sure that our military personnel and our veterans are getting care. like I said, we have food inspectors in the FDA making sure that all of our food is safe to eat. Also in the FDA making sure our prescription drugs are safe and it's okay to take them. You know, we have members of Border Patrol, you know, putting their lives on the line every day, making sure that our country is safe. It's not just people sitting at a desk, you know, entering numbers. Not at all.
Well, I saw a documentary which I'd seen before the other day, and it was about the capture of Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a team effort, obviously, but this focused on the CIA team, a number of whom were women, and it was just incredibly impressive. And you think, I pass these people on the GW Parkway,
yeah,
and I see them in the McLean's, the Starbucks, and what if there is a Starbucks in McLean? But these are all around us here in the D.C. area, and yet they're just friends, neighbors.
Yeah.
But they're doing some incredible stuff.
Exactly. And like I said, you know, the majority of federal workers, they're outside the Beltway. You know, they're across America.
14% are in the Washington area, which means that the vast majority are elsewhere. And as you said, California is the big place. But in fact, I had a column earlier this week listing predicting the election or the primary outcomes, but listing some of these states and the huge number of federal workers and federal retirees that are in these states. They're all old enough to vote.
Yep.
They're all, for the most part, they're better educated than the general public. The jobs are different. They're not of the retail variety. And mm-hmm. so these are people to be reckoned with.
Oh, yeah. I would say the majority of federal employees, they have at least a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
You have higher amounts, you know, higher percentage of employees with, you know, a graduate degree or a PhD, law degree, what have you, than you'd see in the private sector.
When we were talking before, you said you wanted to talk about an update on the repeal of cuts to TDY. What does that mean?
So back in November of 2014, DOD instituted cuts to per diem allowances for temporary duty assignments, TDY,
mm-hmm.
For those who are gone between 30 and 180 days. They saw a reduction of 25%. And for those gone more than 180 days, they saw a reduction of 55%. So what that means is, you know, so say we have FMA has a member from Puget Sound Naval Shipyard, and they got to go work on a boat in Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in New Hampshire. So you're flying across the country. You're looking for a hotel lodging in that area that is already below the government rate. And it's hard out there. And, you know, people aren't finding suitable accommodations. There and any costs that doesn't fall under that reduction of per diems, they got to put up front.
Well, so for somebody who doesn't like to travel or be away from home for an extended period of time, this is a real incentive not to do it.
Yeah, and that's the other problem. Like, a lot of people just, you know, they don't want to take on the financial burden. And I know also our members, because they're managers, they can't find people to volunteer
makes,
for TDY.
Makes sense. Katie, thank you so much for being with
you.
Us. Our producer, Lauren Larson, is giving me the evil eye here, so we've got to get out of here. Glad to have you with us. Everybody be careful. Hope to see you here next Wednesday.
Thanks so much.